Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want the economy to work right, businesses have to work right too. Why they're not, and what can be done on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here. It's the 17th of August, and the program today is going to go a little something like this. We'll have the top of the news as usual, and then we will segue seamlessly into our broader coverage of this week, the breakdown, we're calling it, our economy one step at a time. The theme of this Wednesday is a simple one, but oh so important, businesses and how they try to get by. First, though, there is the small matter of exactly where this economy is going. It's a tricky thing to measure, but that doesn't stop anybody from trying. Two big inflation indicators come out this week. The Consumer Price Index, which is tomorrow, and the Producer Price Index today. This morning, we learned wholesale prices, that's the PPI, rose at their fastest clip in 6 months. So, is that good? Is it bad? What would we like to see that'll let us feel the economy's actually on the mend? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has that story.
After the apocalyptic market tsunami freakout panic of last week, a lot of us are still disoriented. What just happened? Where are we? Today, we have our first economic indicator that's been released since then. The prices companies paid for their raw materials rose 7% in July compared with a year ago. Milton Israti is a partner at Lord Abbett, an investment firm in New Jersey. He says the price index is jumping way too fast.
Obviously, if costs rise, living standards fall.
Food prices drove the index up this time. It's getting more expensive for companies to produce the food we eat. That's why Uncle Sam stepped up this week with the Great Chicken Bailout. The government paid $40 million to buy the chicken that Americans are dropping from their shopping lists. It will give it to soup kitchens. Keep in mind, this price index measures the past, not the future, and the government thinks food prices are too unstable to use when it measures inflation.
At this point, I would not consider the direction of prices to be a signal at all about the recovery.
That skeptical voice is Mike Mandel. He's the chief economic strategist at the Progressive Policy Institute. He says we should just accept that prices are going to go up for consumers and businesses alike. Inflation is inevitable. A recovery isn't.
It's possible for prices to go up even if the U.S. economy is not recovering.
Tomorrow, the Consumer Price Index will come out to help round out the picture. We may get another clue then. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
There was a grim picture of the recession's impact on children out today from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. 20% of the children in this country, the foundation says, lived in poverty in 2009. That's one in five kids, and that's just the official number. A more realistic view of what it takes to get by nowadays puts that figure at more than 40%. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
Last year, nearly 8 million children had at least one parent looking for work. That's 11% of kids, and twice the number before the recession started in 2007.
The state that leads the pack is Nevada. 16% of children in Nevada had at least one unemployed parent.
The Casey Foundation's Laura Speer says Nevada also leads the pack for children affected by foreclosure. 13% of kids in the state have lost their homes due to unpaid mortgages, and that doesn't include renters.
You know what surprises me is that it's that low.
Fulala Riley is with HELP of Southern Nevada. The group assists families facing joblessness and foreclosure. While parents may recover, the effects on children can be lasting. Experts say they're less likely to finish high school and to escape poverty as adults. In Southern Nevada, Riley says half of kids don't graduate.
It's hard for a student to stay focused in, you know, getting good grades when they don't know where they're going to sleep that night, or they don't know where their next meal is coming from.
There are some glimmers of progress. Linda Southward is director of Mississippi Kids Count. She says the state reduced infant mortality and teen birth rates and the percentage of teens not in school. But when it comes to the overall well-being of children, Mississippi has been at the bottom of the list for a decade.
When you have that visual of runners at the starting gate, Mississippi is not on the starting line.
The Casey Report does propose some solutions, like programs to prevent foreclosure and subsidize child care and health insurance, this at a time when governments are cutting back everywhere. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all three major indices had a nice bump at the open. Tried to hold on, but couldn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's an unbelievable amount of cash floating around out there. Unbelievable as in well into the 13-digit range. Standard & Poor's says just the non-financial companies in the S&P 500, that is to say, not including banks and insurance companies, have socked away more than $1 trillion. A record, should you be curious. Also up 12% from last year. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains that companies have good reasons to stuff their piggy banks, whether the economy's up or down.
What do companies do with all that cash? It's easy to imagine it like some sort of New Yorker cartoon, where a CEO luxuriates in a room stacked high with $1,000 bills, just smelling the money. But corporate cash has good use beyond the sheer pleasure of it.
Companies, I think, are fearing the future. And if you have cash, you can ride through bad times.
Robert Duvick is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
In a way, companies use cash the same way we use cash, to store purchasing power until we need it.
So sort of like an emergency fund I have in case my car breaks down.
A big one, yes. And they're worried about a lot more than the car breaking down.
The last recession was more like the whole road crumbling. Credit markets froze up, and companies didn't have access to the cash they depended on to make purchases and investments. So they're holding on to more money now. There are other reasons for the tight-fistedness. For one, companies might not see any good places to put their cash. No clear investments to make. Also,
the company that operates conservatively is doing so in the interest of its shareholders, certainly, but also in the interest of its employees.
Robert Mittelstadt is dean of the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University. Sure, he says, the company might not be hiring right now, but it's using its money to ensure it'll be able to keep the employees it has if things go bad. Some jobs are better than no jobs. And Mittelstadt says there's another reason big stacks of cash are good in uncertain markets.
That opportunities come up that you didn't know about.
Maybe it's a good time to attack your business rival. Maybe it's a good time to swallow them up.
So competitors may be going out of business, or competitors may have difficulty. And then the question is, do you want to buy that competitor outright for a cheap price at a bargain?
Mittelstadt says cash-rich companies can take advantage of uncertainty, capitalize on it for the day, whenever it is, when things are clearly heading up. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We missed Christmas in July, but you can safely say it's Christmas in August in New York City. Manhattan is hosting the New York International Gift Fair this week, the last real opportunity for retailers to stock up before the holidays. And if you think it's tough to figure out consumer behavior in the present tense, imagine trying to project 4 months ahead. For the first time in 3 years, the trade show had so much demand from vendors that at least all of its exhibit space. But then came the debt downgrade and the markets the past 2 weeks and the ensuing economic agita. Sally Herships stopped by the show to see how sellers and buyers are coping.
Marty Kubicki makes nightlights and wall sconces. They're porcelain and decorated with pictures of fairies and trees.
And note these are also on rotating bases, too, rotating fixtures, so you could sort of point it differently.
Oh.
See, it looks like a wall sconce that
right.
way.
Right.
Kubicki has come to New York from California to sell his wares at this week's gift fair. It's a trade show where retailers go to stock up for the holiday season. Kubicki is one of 3,000 exhibitors. You can find everything from his nightlights to designer baby accessories to solar-powered wind chimes. That's what you're listening to now. The recession changed how Kubicki ran his business. 3 years ago, he had 10 employees. 4 left and he hasn't replaced them. And a lot of the retailers he sold to stopped answering their phones.
They would just not be there. At least a couple hundred of my customers, a couple hundred have gone down in the last couple of years.
That's a tenth of the stores he sells to. To make up for lost sales, Kubicki had to start selling directly to the public at craft festivals. So after all the craziness in the markets last week, it's understandable that he was a little nervous. This is the last big trade show of the season. His booth and plane ticket were already booked, so Kubicki says he cut back on other travel costs.
We got a little cooler for the room. We were making cereal in the morning.
Yet despite all his concerns, while we were talking, a buyer walked up. Tammy Close seemed really taken with his night lights, especially the ones with the fairies.
This is what I need. I need every fairy either in a box
or
in that frame item.
Close is buying merchandise for one of her New Jersey gift shops, and I asked her how her business is doing.
We're actually doing really, really well. As long as you have the right price point, you know, when you stay within that price point, people feel like they can treat themselves to something.
Like Kubicki's nightlights, which Close is picking up for $26 a piece. Kubicki's gift show sales are up 40% over last year, and Close is one of over 30 new clients for him.
I came here a little frightened, and it's been okay, so I'm happy.
Maybe the only missing element is a price increase. Kubicki says his material costs and expenses have gone up, but he's just not ready to ask his clients to pay more. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
I like side view fairies more than front view fairies.
Then there's the colored version of those three top fairies up on the top.
The one thing that's certain about what's going on in this economy is that there's a whole lot of stuff happening that's not very certain. That's the second half of the broadcast today, how businesses, both big and small, are dealing with that. But right now, a perspective on how we got here from commentator and business writer Megan McArdle.
During the 2008 primaries, I was puzzled by all the people throwing themselves so furiously into campaigning. Why would anyone want the presidency? It seemed clear to me that a number of trends were about to converge into a very unhappy time for America. I'm not claiming I predicted the financial crisis. I didn't. But I did see a popping housing bubble and a nation that had stopped saving because, after all, their houses were so valuable. I saw that we'd likely have a recession because, well, you usually do after 8 years of growth. And I saw that there was no agreement among experts, voters, or politicians on how to fix any of these problems. 3 years later, it's even worse than I expected. The financial crisis has made it hard for over-indebted households to repair their balance sheets. That's depressed demand for longer than usual and sent unemployment skyrocketing. Many people have been out of work for years now. Many may never work again. This is a tragedy for them and an economic loss to their nation. Meanwhile, the federal deficit balloons as tax collections collapse and welfare spending rises. Much of the added government spending is a good idea, but it will still be a drag on growth when the economy finally starts to recover. The financial crisis has also destroyed whatever political consensus we had, both about fixing our short-term economic woes and about our creeping fiscal disaster. The political dynamic has turned towards actively making things worse. Out of concern for the deficits, we've somehow managed to put our nation's credit rating at risk, and yet we've utterly failed to outline a credible plan for either the country or the debt. All this just adds to uncertainty about the future, and uncertainty about the future makes it hard to invest in a new business, a new product, or a new idea. 3 years ago, I saw the wounds that economic trends were going to inflict. What I didn't see was the ones we'd inflict on ourselves.
Megan McArdle is a business writer at The Atlantic magazine. Next week in this space, Robert Reich. Your thoughts, whenever's good for you. Send them to us online, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, tell me one more time why companies aren't adding jobs.
I'm afraid to hire someone. Once we hire someone today, then all of a sudden, you know, 6 months downstream, we start slowing up again. We don't want to have to lay that person off.
But first, Let's do the numbers. Yeah, I can't believe I'm really saying this, but it was a ho-hum day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials inched up just 4 points today. That's less than a tenth of 1%, closed at 11,410. The NASDAQ slid 11 points, less than a half percent, ended at 2511. The S&P 500 snuck up just a point, less than a tenth percent, finished at 1193. Investors honed in on retailers after both Target and Staples topped earnings forecasts. Shares of Target hiked 2 1/3% higher. Staples printed a half percent gain. Costco jumped 1 1/3%. Meantime, Coca-Cola bubbled up more than 1.5%. Pepsi popped up more than 1 1/3%. Tech companies tanked after Dell lowered its revenue targets for the year. Dell dropped 10%. Hewlett-Packard unloaded more than 3.5%. Cisco Systems unplugged nearly 1% on this Wednesday. Bonds kept on rising. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, presenting the Jefferson Innovation Summit, a conversation about creating and sustaining an entrepreneurial future. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com. For the latest business news, go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletters tab to get business and economic news delivered to you daily, right now to your inbox. Listen to the numbers on your own time. Download the new Marketplace Radio iPhone app for on-demand access to all of our radio programs right on your iPhone. Coming soon for the Android.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for July. How much more or less are consumers paying for food, fuel, and medical care? The Labor Department issues its monthly Consumer Price Index. And he founded the Sundance Institute. Robert Redford turns 75. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. On a program the theme of which is businesses and how they're dealing with what seems to be the new economic normal. It'd be handy, don't you think, to chat with a major American industrial conglomerate, especially one that's been on a tear this year, back in place as the number one global leader in its sector, almost $3 billion in quarterly profits last time we checked. And yet, also one beholden to taxpayers for its $50 billion bailout and still, in fact, part owned by the government. So when I talked to General Motors CEO Dan Akerson not long ago, I asked him how he's feeling business-wise.
Well, all of this uncertainty really adds up to undermine consumer confidence. And I think the most recent economic report I saw was consumer spending was down for the first time in 2 years, which means people are probably saving because they're a little less sure about the future. So we have to plan for the worst and hope for the best. And by virtue of reducing our cost structure, our break-even point, we've been able to make money at a 40-year low, whereas before we couldn't make money at a 20-year high in terms of vehicle production in North America, and that, I think that applies around the globe. On a microeconomic basis, we're like any household. We think we've got some savings, and we're not out buying jewelry and things like that.
One of the things you've been able to do, Mr. Akerson, as GM has gotten more profitable and begun selling more cars the past couple of years, is to hire back some of the people who you were forced to lay off as you closed plants. Do you worry that the economic weakness now might force you to rethink some of those hires?
I don't think so. I mean, I worry about it, everything, but I think we've been very prudent in hiring people back. I mean, obviously, we can't control everything, and if things were to get a lot worse, obviously, we're going to have to review the bidding. That being said, we've invested another $5.5 billion, roughly, in new plant and equipment in this country, and try to make sure that we're as efficient and as quality-based as we can be. And as you say, we've made great progress, but the future is always difficult to read, and we just don't want to overextend ourselves in the current economic environment.
You know, that investment point you made is a good one, because one of the things that's been happening in the economy is that businesses aren't really investing because they're a little uncertain, just as consumers are uncertain. Step back from GM for a minute and look at the broader economy and help me understand when major companies in this economy might start investing.
Well, you know, job creation is critical to any recovery. And I think what I've been trying to do, and I think met with at least some preliminary success, is to view our industrial relations with the UAW in a completely different way. They are partners. And what we're trying to do is say, look, if management gets a bonus, then I think our hourly people ought to get a bonus. And that way, we share in each other's success. We're all motivated along the same lines. And I think that would make it easier for companies to say and open up a new era, I think, of more productive dialogue between management and labor. That's what the environment I hope to, and the management team here hopes to create at General Motors.
Let me see if I can re-ask that same question in a slightly different way and maybe get you away from GM and management and labor relations. How are we going to get out of this?
Look, you know, I'm not a politician, I'm not a policymaker, and I don't want to be one. But we can't run the deficits we're running. And I think both political parties and I think the President of the United States, we all agree to that. And so once you kind of get things more in balance and come up with a plan that gets our financial house in order, when you create some certainty, some predictability where business feels that they understand the rules. If there's a new tax regime, I'd like to know what it is. Is there going to be incentive for research and development? Are there job credits or not? And I'm not espousing one way or another. I want to know what the rules are going to be. And I think we're kind of caught in this moment. There's a pause. And it goes back to the initial part of our discussion is, you know, uncertainty is it drives people to distraction. And it's not a particularly pleasant experience to try to guess what is the environment going to be a year or two down the road.
Dan Akerson, the CEO of General Motors. Mr. Akerson, thanks so much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
Cast your mind back with me to the beginning of the month. It seems like forever ago, I know, but it's only been 2 weeks, actually, since we got the July unemployment report. 117,000 new jobs were added to the economy last month, all of them from the private sector, that is companies, not the government. As we know all too well, though, we're not adding new jobs fast enough because, to make a very long story, just somewhat shorter, businesses aren't sure they're going to have enough work. So Marketplace's Jennifer Collins went out to find out exactly how one of those new jobs came to be.
Bob White's family has owned a small manufacturing company in an L.A. suburb for more than 50 years. White's business, Janda Company, employs 23 people.
We make machines that will make your shopping carts, machines that will make bumpers, machines that make parts for Boeing or Lockheed for the aerospace industry.
Last November, orders for those machines quadrupled. White started running the company 10 hours a day and on Saturdays. But he debated adding to his payroll.
Do we really need to hire that person? Or should we just work more hours? Or, you know, why should we hire that person?
Janda is one of 29 million small businesses in the U.S. These companies employ half of all workers in the country. Many are struggling to grow. That's according to Pepperdine University professor John Paglia.
The primary concern of business owners in this economy is access to capital.
Loans and lines of credit. The Obama administration has promised $22 billion in loan guarantees for small businesses. Private banks loan most of that money.
They're having a tough time sorting through the applications for these small business owners because of the spotty recent financial performance.
Paglia says banks want to see a boost in revenue before they make loans. And because of the recession, few businesses can show cash flow, and so they can't get the money to grow and hire.
Do you have any examples of people who have, or businesses that have been successful in adding jobs?
This is Paglia's actual pause. Now, keep in mind, he surveys hundreds of small businesses for Pepperdine.
No. Let me think for a minute.
Linda Bedrosian counsels several small businesses through the Los Angeles nonprofit SCORE. I asked her the same question.
Right now, none. The need is certainly there. I think every single one of my clients, at least I would say they would ask for five people or more.
Bedrosian says that's preventing small businesses, which she calls feeders, from becoming larger.
If we don't have the feeder businesses that are basically the fuel to our economy, that's a problem.
Back at Janda Company, Bob White was still resistant to hire. That is, until he started falling behind on orders for equipment.
Going crazy. It's like, we need more help. We just can't get the product out.
In desperation, he reached out to Joe Talley, the grandson of a current worker. Talley had been unemployed for over a year.
My grandpa called and said, get your butt down here. You got a job. So showed up and started working.
Now he's learning to weld and getting other on-the-job training.
Doing whatever they tell me to do and watching them do it and trying to learn it myself.
And you'll be here for as long as you can.
As long as they'll let me stay.
So Talley has a job, but his boss, Bob White, is cautious about adding another.
Because I'm afraid to hire someone. Once we hire someone today, then all of a sudden, you know, 6 months downstream, we start slowing up again. We don't want to have to lay that person off.
And other business owners may be feeling that anxiety, too. A recent survey from Gallup shows 16% of small business owners expect to hire in the next year. That number is about half of what it was in January. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which S&P gets the bum's rush. At least three municipalities across the country have decided they no longer wish to do business with the ratings agency. The city of Los Angeles, Manatee County, Florida, and San Mateo County in California, up near San Francisco, all had their credit ratings reduced by S&P last week from AAA to double, much like the federal government. So officials in all three places promptly canceled their contracts with S&P, contracts in which they paid S&P to rate the bonds they issue to raise capital. It's called taking your ball and going home. And this is a radio program called Marketplace from APM American Public Media. That's it today. We got to go. The Dow inched up 4 points on this Wednesday, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ off 11 points, less than 0.5%. The S&P 500 bumped up just a point, less than a tenth of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can get the latest installment of The Breakdown, Our Economy, One Step at a Time, tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. Coming up next time back here, I say debt, you say...
It's something to be scared of. It's obviously something I don't want to think about a lot, but...
Yeah, that's an ominous laugh, I'd say. Debt, good and bad. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.